Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have with me a serial entrepreneur, a person who's extremely accomplished in business, Mr. Dhruv Agarwal. Dhruv, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ashutosh. Delighted to be on the show.
Thank you. Dhruv is the group CEO of PropTiger.com, Housing.com and Makan.com. He used to work for GE earlier and he's an MBA from Harvard Business School. So Dhruv, tell me a little bit about your early life and some of your early learnings.
So Ashutosh, I grew up in Calcutta, mm-hmm. and went to the US for my education. So got my engineering degrees, in material science and engineering in the US, and then got my business degree there as well.
Yeah.
Between my engineering degrees and my business degree, I started an iron ore mining company in Orissa, which of course was sort of my first real significant managerial and business experience. And it was an amazing journey for me. I was about 25 years old, when I got into that. That was sort of around 1994 or 95. Okay. And at that point in time, technology was sort of just emerging and the internet boom was just at its start, at least the first phase. But I went into an old world business such as mining, and it was fascinating for me. I mean, I think some of the lessons learned very similar to what most entrepreneurs learn in their first enterprise. One was obviously the challenge of how to build a team. Mm. At 25 years of age, being in mining, most of the team I ended up building were people far more senior in age than I was. So of course, able to build that team. To gain acceptance, as a very young entrepreneur. Mm. Back in 94, it was different. Today, I think if you're not 25, it's a disadvantage. But in those days, it was very different.
Yes.
And then obviously, it was a difficult business, highly regulated. So one had to be really resilient. There were challenges which were thrown at you every day. But just the sheer ability of sort of not giving up and, bouncing back was something I learned. And I think it stands me in good stead today.
Wonderful. So let's move on. Let's talk about the real estate world, which is from mining to real estate. I mean, I just set up an iron ore mining company. I said, wow, at 25, people would say, I set up something here. You go and set up full iron ore mining company. That's quite amazing. Dhruv, you have three brands that I'm aware of, PropTiger, Housing, and Makan. How do you differentiate between these three?
I'll start first with sort of Housing and PropTiger, and then talk a little bit about Makan. So Housing essentially is what we call an online classifieds company for real estate. Okay. So essentially, brokers, developers, homeowners can list their properties, and whatever audience or traffic comes onto our platform, we pass on inquiries for those properties to the respective developer, broker, or homeowner. Mm. And we make money on advertising revenues and listing fees. PropTiger, on the other hand, is an online brokerage. So we essentially help people all the way from search and discovery on our platform to handholding them through the entire transaction and also helping them with the financing for their property. So in that sense, it's a soup to nuts platform, while housing.com is more of a classifieds. Okay. An advertising-led platform.
Okay.
Makan works more as a flanking brand to Housing. So just given even its name, it's got much higher audience in tier 2 cities, as well as it tends to have an audience at slightly lower price points. So it works as a great complementary brand to Housing, but the model is the same as Housing's.
Okay. And, over the years, I see the entire real estate business seems to be getting organized when players like you have started coming in. And yet, it is quite disorganized. When we used to live overseas, and I'm sure you've seen it, my brother was trying to rent a house and he says, why can't I just hand it over to somebody like in Singapore and they take care of everything? So I said, listen, it doesn't work like that in India.
Right.
What are your thoughts on this?
So look, there are two aspects, to real estate, when you talk about it being organized or unorganized. One is, of course, the construction piece, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there, and that's where I think, real estate has got some of its so-called, bad name or murkiness, right? Mm-hmm. But I think on that front, a lot has changed in the last 3 to 4 years.
Right.
So a lot of, you know, traditional corporate houses, such as Godrej, Mahindra's, Tata's, you know, now the Aditya Birla Group.
Yeah.
And we're seeing more of these groups come in and are, you know, getting into the real estate business.
Mm.
So that's kind of, they're bringing their, you know, corporate culture, they're bringing their corporate practices. They're just, you know, changing the way business is done. You know, you've obviously had, you know, a few real estate only players like, you know, DLF, Prestige, Brigade, many others. You know, there are enough of those names as well, which have been around for a while. But I think there were a large number of, or a long tail of developers who sometimes, you know, necessarily did not follow the right practices.
Right.
And that kind of gave a bad name to the industry. So I think it is getting now organized on the developer side. You know, with all the crises we face with the Real Estate Regulatory Act coming in, I think we are seeing a shakeout of that industry, and it's becoming more transparent, more corporatized, you know, in that sense.
Right.
On the sales and marketing side, again, you know, you traditionally we've seen it globally. It tends to be a fragmented industry. You know, in the United States, there are over 1 million plus brokers, if not more. India has hundreds of thousands of brokers and of all types. And you know, it tends to be a mom and pop kind of enterprise, because there are no regulations around the training you need in order to become a broker. So it has been disorganized in that sense. But again, in the last 5 years, we've seen a lot of organized players like us and many others who are not only organizing brokerage, but also the portals such as, you know, ours have come and it transformed the way property is searched for. So you no longer, you know, go and look for property by, you know, talking to a neighborhood broker. Your first port of call is Google, and then you come on to platforms such as ours.
Right.
So in that sense, you know, we are seeing construction getting organized, we are seeing distribution getting organized, and we think that the best for real estate, you know, still lies ahead of us.
Sure. But then tell me, you know, when I look at what's happening with young people overseas, you know, both my sons work overseas. Within a year and a half, 2 years, they acquired their own homes. Why is it so difficult for a young person to acquire a home in India?
So, you know, I think that's changing, Asutosh. It's no longer the case. You know, what we find that average age for a person buying property, you know, through our portals is about 30 to 32. So it is fairly young. So today, you know, frankly, if you are a dual income family, let's say, you know, earning about, you know, 10 to 12 lakhs annually, you can easily, you know, afford to buy a home. And if you've got some savings, you know, from the past, or if you've got some support from parents, friends or family, even at a lower dual income, annual income, you can afford to buy a home. So I would say the process has become far more easier than the times, you know, when maybe you or I were looking to buy our first home. So I would say it's very accessible these days. And frankly, you know, in today's environment, you know, when interest rates are at a multi-year low, I know prices have been relatively stable over the last 5 years. It's as good a time as it gets for young people to, so as to say, you know, get onto the ladder of buying real estate.
Interesting. But yet, you know, when I speak to a lot of millennials who are, and now the Gen Zs, they're not really wanting to acquire, and I'm finding more and more young people want to rent. What is your thoughts on that?
So I agree with that, Ashutosh. There is this sort of, you know, sentiment around, you know, renting versus buying. And I think that's just to do with the nature of the gig economy. You know, we are used to a shared economy. Automobiles is one prime example where people are saying, hey, you know, why buy a car?
Right.
When, you know, and then, you know, have the associated cost of the driver, the unutilized asset or the underutilized asset, when we can just hop, you know, into an Ola or an Uber and, you know, and get our job done.
Correct.
So I think it's the same sort of sentiment as far as home buying is concerned. If you look at rental yields in India, as far as residential real estate is concerned, it's anywhere between 2 to 3%.
Yep.
And mortgages, even today, you know, when they're at a multi-year low, it's 7%. So as one would call it, it is classically a negative carry rate in that sense. So it makes more sense in that sense for people to kind of, you know, take that decision, especially as I said, you know, when the entire economy is becoming a gig economy, plus you're getting these co-living players, which are offering you, you know, flexibility. When you move, you can move from one center in Bangalore to another center in Gurgaon if you move, world-class amenities, the ability to live in a community, events which are organized. Mm. So I think there are a lot of pulls, you know, in that direction of, you know, renting. However, I think what's been interesting for us is as the pandemic has hit us, you know, we've seen a distinct shift in terms of audience preferences between February of this year and now. So, you know, while our overall audience on our platforms, you know, is up by 50%, because I think of the just general adoption of sort of the digital medium by people, we found that rental interest has come down and interest for buying homes has gone up. Amazing. And back to bigger homes. So I think what I feel, Asutosh, is that the pandemic has made people realize that home is probably the only safe haven you have.
Correct.
Hence, the way people relate to their homes, I think, may have undergone a shift. So I think over the next few years, you'll see this tension between, you know, people wanting to rent a home and also people recognizing the fact that a home is something which is your sort of your own, your haven, which you don't want to be at the mercy of a landlord. So they may want to buy. So you will see this tension, and I'm sure at different points in time, you'll see different preferences prevailing.
So, you know, very interesting you say that. You know, as you were talking, I was reminded of my grandmother. He always said that, you know, in India, zar and zameen, gold and land, are something that you just have to keep on investing in. And I've spoken to so many friends in China and another old civilization where exactly the same thing holds. Do you think land will continue to be as attractive an investment as it has traditionally been in our country?
So look, I think I can understand the, so there one is the sentiment around owning land. So I think that hasn't changed. So whenever, you know, we are doing a plotted development or selling a plotted development on behalf of a developer versus apartments, I think plotted development has this fascination for many, many people still, because they're buying this piece of land, however small, and then they can build whatever they want of their choice on that, right?
Right.
So from a sentiment standpoint, it remains. From an attractiveness as an investment, you know, we did see a re-rating of real estate, Asutosh, between, say, 2004 and 2012, right? Where anybody who owned any piece of real estate, land, probably returned 4 or 5 or 6x of what they had. So to expect those kind of returns over a period of time, you know, are less likely to happen, especially in the bigger cities, you know, where I think prices, you know, have already gone up. People are more familiar with sort of upcoming areas, you know, things are already priced in, right? However, you know, as you look at new emerging towns, new developments, I think you'll always find pockets where land can give you extraordinarily high returns. Because of the fundamental nature of a city is changed, or industrialization happens, or let's say the smart city you know, mission that we have, if it really takes off, then you'll find land in these places giving you more than sort of normal returns on real estate.
Very interesting. So let me move to the second part of our show, which is, you know, talk to you about startups. You've done, you know, many since the time you were 25. So my first question to you, Dhruv, is, what is the advantage of having a partner versus going solo? I'm asking this because a lot of young people ask me this question.
You know, I think, look, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, do worry about, say, you know, if I have a partner, I'm going to share my equity, right? I start with 50% ownership if you're two, as opposed to 100% ownership. That obviously, you know, plays a role in terms of dilution.
Correct.
But having said that, I think, you know, my preference is towards having a partner for a few reasons. Mm-hmm. One is it clearly you know, serves as a sounding board for you. There's somebody whose interests are completely aligned with you, and, you know, you have the freedom of sharing everything, you know, with that person and getting, you know, the right feedback.
Right.
So it's important you choose a person who actually has the ability to do that. So that's critical. Mm-hmm. Second thing, I think, is just the complementary skill sets. It's very difficult for one individual in today's sort of fast-moving businesses to have all the skills to be able to build a successful business. So having a partner to begin with who has a complementary skill set, I think, you know, at least eases that, you know, challenge, you know, to begin with. And then I think, look, you know, we all realize that how lonely it is to be a leader at the top, right? To have a partner, you know, who can sort of, you know, pick you up when, you know, when you're feeling sort of low. And vice versa, I think, you know, is a great thing to have.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, if you ask me, advantages of having a partner far outweigh sort of the dilution which you take place, you know, in your equity as you start up.
I completely agree with you. Thank you. So then my next question is that, again, based on your own experience, and I'm sure you invest in many startups, what, in your opinion, are some of the basic mistakes a lot of startup entrepreneurs make?
So look, you know, I think, you know, some of, you know, the, I think the biggest mistakes people make is actually going back to the earlier question around picking the wrong co-founder, picking the wrong investors. I think what we have to realize that, you know, an investor and a co-founder are like your spouse, right? You have to live with that individual, you know, for a long, long time in your life. And if the person is not compatible, if the person has, you know, a different sort of worldview than yours, then it becomes extremely challenging to make that relationship work. And I say that both for co-founders and for investors. So many, many young entrepreneurs, you know, jump at the first available, you know, capital they get and don't sort of really do a lot of diligence on the nature of the capital. So it's very, very important to pick the right investors, investors who have a demonstrated track record, who are known to be entrepreneur friendly, who are known to stand by you in tough times. I think these are very, very important things. And the other big mistake, which I think is very fundamental again, is people don't treat investor money as their own money. I think some of the biggest, you know, mistakes founders make is by not being frugal. I think it's very, very important to be very judicious with how you spend your money. Because while people might feel that cash is easily available, the fact is that every time you take more money, you do dilute yourselves. And at the end, by the time you do your IPO, you sell your company, if you're in low single digit ownership, that's a lot of hard work, you know, gone in for not as much return as you could get. And we've seen that in the US, you know, when a lot of startups, you know, go public, founders, you know, end up retaining 50 to 60% equity. So I think, you know, getting diluted too fast, too quickly, you know, is also a basic mistake people made. And look, and there are sort of, you know, a host of, you know, other mistakes which people make. But I think these are something which you know, really, really stay with you and are very, very difficult to reverse. Because, you know, otherwise you make mistakes, you learn from your failures. As an entrepreneur, you've got to try new things, be bold, and then sort of learn from that and move on. But these things are things which kind of stay with you. And, you know, when kind of the outcomes hit you, it's too late.
I agree. So my last question on startups before I move to a few questions for you personally. And, you know, this is regarding scaling up. When I speak to private equity, the whole thing is pan India. And I tell a lot of young people, I said, if you're in Gurgaon, stay in Gurgaon. You know, you've got 2 million people who you can go to. At what stage, in your opinion, should a startup start to scale up?
Look, I think it was interesting that you almost gave the answer when you asked the question. But look, I think I wholly agree with you. I think when it becomes dangerous to scale is when you clearly haven't established product market fit. I think it's very, very important to make sure that, you know, you've sort of launched an MVP, right? And you've got feedback, you know, from consumers. You've managed to tweak your product, tweak your offering, and basically have a service or a product which consumers want, right? That's one. The second is, I think, unit economics, right? You have to have, you know, at a basic contribution margin level, a business which is making you money. If that's not making you money, you know, you can scale up and show higher revenues, but that's low quality revenue essentially. So that's again dangerous, because you just end up burning more capital by scaling up, and you really don't get anything out of it. Yep. So I think it's important to get product market fit. It's important to get your unit economics right. Mm-hmm. And you have to get out of that mindset that, look, you know, you're going to buy revenue. Once all of that is resolved, that's the time when you take blocks and basically expand. Sometimes there is an argument to be made that you may want to, you know, start up in two different cities, because Gurgaon may be very different, let's say, from a Chennai. So you may want to have operations in two cities to get sort of a different, you know, worldview. Yep. But otherwise, to your point, you know, you have, India has, you know, depth in, you know, single markets with millions of people. So I think prove the model before you really start scaling up.
That's it. Dhruv, I have time for two or three personal questions for you. My first question is that, are there any people who had a strong influence on your life? And if yes, give me two examples of what you have learned from them.
You know, I think the person who's had the most profound, you know, impact, you know, on my life, I would say is my father. You know, I've sort of, you know, obviously watched and learned. There's been no sort of explicit lessons, you know, imparted in that sense. Hmm. But I think, look, you know, his sense of fairness, you know, integrity, living life through values, again, frugality. These are some of the principles which have really stood me in good stead. You know, a lot of people look to various things, you know, from their parents, inheritances, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what I've really got, you know, from him are these qualities, which I think, again, are qualities which are, you know, for being a successful entrepreneur or manager in any field, you know. And I kind of still look up to him and admire him, you know, for these qualities.
And what would be three words that define Dhruv?
Empathetic. Mm-hmm. I would say resilient. I would say, you know, trustworthy.
Well said. All great qualities. My next question is that if you were a role model to millions of children who closely followed you and your life choices, what would be the one thing you would change within yourself?
You know, I would say that, you know, I'm an entrepreneur and most people would associate me with, you know, being a risk taker. You know, which I am. But I sometimes feel that, you know, one thing which I would change within me is I would become a little bit bolder. Okay. than who I am today.
Wow.
And I think it's important in today's day for young children to actually be bold, you know, take decisions, learn from their mistakes as they fail, and then, you know, move on from there. And that's critical for success, especially in today's environment.
Wonderful. So Dhruv, my last question to you, you know, thousands of people are going to sit and watch you and me talk. A lot of them would be potential entrepreneurs. What would your advice be to a young individual who's starting off their entrepreneurial journey?
Well, I think, you know, the most important thing to note is, especially if you track the careers of several entrepreneurs, it's a long and arduous journey. You know, we do hear of stories where a company starts out 2 years ago, gets, you know, bought for millions of dollars, yeah, and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, those are only few and far between. The truth of the matter is it's a long journey. You're required to make compromises on various things. You know, work-life balance does go for a toss. To be extremely careful about, you know, taking care of yourself because you can end up compromising, you know, your health. So there are various things which people have to be prepared for. You will have challenges along the way and multiple. Yep. You have to learn to manage your sort of, you know, emotional volatility because you feel, you know, like on top of the world one day and completely in the abyss the other day. So you got to sort of be temperate. I know my philosophy, frankly, you know, which has helped me along the way is to kind of really in this world distinguish between sort of controllables and non-controllables. There's only so much, you know, you can do, right? Because half of the world is a non-controllable. Events dictate what is happening. And there could be no better example than what we've seen in the last, you know, 5 or 6 months.
Absolutely.
I think the only thing which you can effectively do is essentially to, you know, do the best you can on the things you can control. Mm. And that's how I kind of, you know, manage myself. If things don't go too well, I say, hey, look, Dhruv, as long as you've done your best, I think it's good. When things go very well, you know, be a little bit more modest and humble because things could have happened because you just happened to be at the right place at the right time. So that's how I kind of, you know, lead my life. And that's what I would advise people as well who are starting up to do.
Wonderful. Very wise words. Dhruv, thank you very much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for being on The Brand Called You.
Likewise, Ashutosh, it was really nice talking to you and all the best.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.